It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we make space to discuss former President Donald Trump pleading not guilty this week to 34 felony charges issued by Manhattan prosecutors. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, what's come up for you in the meantime. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, set this up for us. How significant is this, a former president being criminally charged?
Well, it's significant because it hasn't happened before. Usually we think about our presidents as kind of fading into the sunset, becoming some type of elder statesperson, doing charity projects. With the exception of Grover Cleveland, we're not used to seeing presidents who lose elections come back and then try to run again for office. And we are also not used to presidents being as bombastic as Donald Trump has been. So Donald Trump didn't go away quietly, and there was a specter of criminal activity around him on a number of reasons. And so for that reason, we expected that there was going to be some type of criminal indictment at some point in his post-presidency. I think that the larger question was it going to be this case first, or was it going to be one of the other cases where there are charges that actually more directly relate to his conduct at the end of his presidency?
We're going to put a pin on that because I want to ask you about that in just a moment. But first, looking at Manhattan, how serious are the charges against Trump?
Of all of the allegations that are being investigated right now against former President Trump, these are probably the least serious. So falsifying business records by itself is a misdemeanor in New York. It's being raised to a felony count in New York because of the allegation that the falsification took place in the commission of another crime. And I think the really interesting kind of and admittedly somewhat tricky legal strategy here is to claim that the commissions of other crimes were campaign finance violations. Alvin Bragg appears to be trying to say that not only is this a violation of federal election law, which would be interesting given his position as a law enforcement officer for the county of New York, and not necessarily somebody who's connected to the federal government, but also he's saying this is a violation of New York state law as well. And so that raises it to a felony. If he were to be convicted and get jail time, he wouldn't get a lot of jail time for relatively speaking, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know, especially given the number of counts that we have, how long that would actually extend the sentence if it were to get to that particular point. But, you know, the allegations that are being raised in terms of election interference and possibly insurrection and the documents issues that are raised by the papers that were found at Mar-a-Lago have, if he were to be convicted, carry much stiffer fines and would probably be viewed in the minds of many people as being more serious.
So you mentioned Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Do you have insight into what Bragg will argue that the underlying crime was here? Because, I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that violations of campaign finance laws could come into play, but how does that overlap then with federal law? And I know that qualifying this, you're not a lawyer, but I mean, I think there are complications here about what is New York state law versus what is federal law.
In his press conference after the arraignment, D.A. Bragg said that there were both New York and federal campaign finance violations that he was using to bump up the misdemeanor charges to felonies. So I think he's going to do a bit of a both-and approach so that if he does get challenged on the you can't prosecute a federal case angle, that he can then invoke New York state campaign finance laws to say that this was in violation of New York state law, and because it happened in New York and because there was an election going on in New York, that was certainly a part of the federal system, because it's important to realize that we don't have one big national election system. We have 50 different elections that are going on at the same time that are being run individually at the state level. He's going to try to be able to make that case. And so, you know, I expect that Trump's team is going to, you know, make some motions to try to dismiss on those particular grounds, and we'll see whether or not The judge actually takes those seriously, and whether or not he chooses to dismiss any of the charges on those grounds.
Yes. Andra, can you explain the process from here? I mean, he's made his first court appearance. We've heard the specific charges. What happens in coming months, coming weeks? What is the process?
So the next court date is scheduled for December. So right now, what the lawyers are doing on both sides is they're putting the case together. They are sharing information. So it's part of due process. There's a discovery period where everybody is supposed to get all of the evidence together so that they are on an equal playing field, so that there aren't supposed to be any surprises, you know, in court that President Trump's lawyers have seen everything that the district attorney's office is bringing against him, and they have an opportunity to be able to construct a rebuttal. I also expect that they're going to be doing lots of kind of preliminary motions, that will, you know, attempt to try to get this case dismissed offhand between now and then. So, you know, this is a somewhat quiet phase of the trial, but it's a really important phase where both sides are going to be putting their case together,
laying
and
their groundwork
with each other. Yeah, so mm-hmm. so that President Trump gets his due process.
Talking about the indictment of former President Trump, Andra Gillespie is here, associate professor of political science at Emory University. You can join in with your questions and what you've been thinking about your comments. 800-642-1234. Andra, Trump and allies, liberals as well, have called the case politically motivated. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said it is a weaponization of the American criminal justice system. How valid are these concerns?
Well, that's in and of itself a political statement.
Hmm.
You know, and it's not surprising that people who would be aligned with President Trump either very closely or people who would be aligned with him because he shares the same political party would also make these types of claims, because it hasn't happened before. And also, I think because many people think that if President Trump had a conventional post-presidency when he was riding off into the sunset, they probably wouldn't have tried to pursue these charges against him, and they would have let sleeping dogs lie, if you will. There's the idea that they're doing this specifically to try to prevent him from running for office. And then, you know, President Trump says lots of things, and so he's testing out this idea that he can claim victimhood and, you know, see if he can get away with that and rally support for him. And it's been really effective this in the past week for him to be able to raise money. And even kind of going into this week, he was consolidating support in public opinion surveys around his candidacy. So he, you know, his vote share amongst likely Republican primary voters had actually increased in data that had come out the week before. So from a political strategy, yeah, it perfectly makes sense for him to come out and claim that this is a witch hunt, because that's the type of red meat statement that is going to rally his base, who already, you know, have a certain level of grievance that Donald Trump was able to use to successfully mobilize them in 2016.
And I noticed that over the no mugshot thing, that the campaign used a fake mugshot on T-shirts to fundraise.
I mean, yeah, that was planned. I mean, so, you know, I had heard about that, you know, even before Trump had been arraigned. And so, you know, when we talk about the notion of fake news and spin, right, people create their own spin to generate their own brand, and they knew that this was going to be politically effective for them. So, you know, the question is that when you're generating the meme yourself, you know, is this propaganda? Is this, you know, honest and accurate? I think it's really important for people to know that the pictures that you saw on the newspapers or on websites of Trump sitting in the courtroom are really what happened, not necessarily the pictures that you would see of the, you know, the computer-generated versions of it, or even ones where you have Trump's face over somebody in a striped uniform, right? Like, you know, that's not reflective of reality. That's just reflective of people gaming for a position.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, our guide to the political ramifications of the former president's indictment and his first day in court this week. Call in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At a news conference outlining the charges brought against former President Donald Trump this week, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg.
These are felony crimes in New York State, no matter who you are. We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
Call in with your questions, your comments about the 34 felonies, the historic arraignment, 800-642-1234. We have Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science, Andra Gillespie, here. Let's bring on a call. Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, hi. What would you like to raise?
Good morning. I just want to note that this crime is in a category of white-collar crime. And my understanding is that white-collar crime is very often and very frequently prosecuted and is considered to be a very serious kind of crime. It's not like a hijacking or a breaking or entering, but it is a form of theft. And I know Trump has said this has never been done before. That's simply silly. New York State, Wisconsin, Illinois, and other places routinely prosecute former governors, governors who become former governors in Illinois and so on and so forth, for stealing from the people. And I just want to make the point that white-collar crime is not some special you-get-out-of-jail-free crime.
And, Rich, what you're saying, it's not an anomaly. Andra, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying, and I think that there's a really important moral point to be made here, because there is an implication in, and I don't think it's intended, but I think we really need to deal with it, in the American body politic, that former presidents are impervious to prosecution, right? If they commit crimes, even if they commit crimes while they're president, right, they don't have blanket immunity for the rest of their lives to not be held accountable for those activities. And so I think it's really important for us to just sort of step back and think about what we're doing, even if we're supporters of the former president, right? The larger question here is, did he do the crime? And the trial is going to bear that out, and he'll get due process for it. And then we could talk about, what the consequences are for it. Nobody is suggesting that he go to jail for 100 years behind this crime if he were to be convicted of it. But I'm a former president, you can't do that to me, is not an excuse, right? Because that would make it above the law. And I think we have to ask what would happen if the tables were turned. So are we saying that George W. Bush could go and shoot somebody and get away with it? Are we saying that Barack Obama could rob a bank? Or are we saying that Bill Clinton could commit arson and we're not supposed to do anything about it because they're former presidents? I don't think so, right? And part of respect for the rule of law and part of the high standard that we hold presidents to, is that they should be modeling good behavior. They shouldn't be modeling criminal activity. And so I think these are at the heart of the allegations. We want to give President Trump the opportunity to have his day in court. And we know that he has the presumption of innocence until being proven guilty. But just the whole idea of you can't do this to me, I'm a former president, that doesn't make any sense. And I think if we were talking to other people in our daily lives, like our kids or our parents, we would not accept that level of argumentation from them. So we shouldn't accept it from President Trump.
Rich, thanks for the call. I want to turn now to these other investigations that are coming up here that are percolating. You had mentioned in Georgia, where you are, Fulton County, looking at whether Trump's efforts to overturn Biden's 2020 election win in that state. There's other, whether Trump broke laws in the Capitol insurrection or the handling of classified documents. What is standing out to you in these other investigations?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of people are a little anxious about the timing of any potential indictments that would come of it. I mean, it is true that this is, you know, unusual in the fact that you have somebody who's actively running for president of the United States at the same time. So any action is going to look politically motivated, even though it isn't. But I also think that, you know, the things that are really interesting that are coming out of that case, particularly the federal case that's being handled by Prosecutor Jack White, are the subpoenas. So Jack White, in the last week or two, has been able to secure a number of judicial victories that are going to require people who hadn't really been particularly forthcoming with their testimony to testify before his grand jury. So, you know, it will be a while before we know what was said in those testimonies. But, you know, it's really interesting now that senior level officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, are going to testify in some way, shape, or form. So we'll see kind of if that produces anything, if it produces anything very quickly. And then in Georgia, you know, the grand jury has been disbanded. They have made their report. And so we're just waiting to see when Fannie Willis announces her decision. And so many people think that it'll happen, you know, sometime within the next month or two. So that's probably the next case that we're going to hear some news about.
Talking with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Andra, can you say a little bit more about the timing of these cases? I mean, what if, say, the New York case extends well into the 2024 presidential campaign season? I mean, could Trump's criminal charges influence his candidacy?
Well, it will not preclude him from running for office.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you know, that's really important. But I think the larger question is, will his base of supporters grow tired of all of the drama, all of the messiness that surrounds being criminally indicted at the same time that you're running for president? So this week it did not. Many people are, you know, sympathetic in the Republican Party to the fact that they view this case as being particularly weak or not serious enough. But especially if other indictments come in more serious cases on issues that were more recent, right? That's also, you know, one of the things that comes up in the Stormy Daniels case, was that this information or the alleged crimes took place before he was president, and the indictment was really interesting because it looks like all the checks happened, and many of the checks at least happened or were written in 2017 after President Trump was in office, and so that might have also partially explained the delay of what was going on in terms of bringing charges. But January 6th and the end of the 2020 election cycle happened 2.5 years ago. And so because of that, right, you need time to put a case together. It's complicated, but 2.5 years really isn't a whole lot of time. So, you know, yes, it's going to complicate things, and I think the bigger question is whether or not people's patience with Trump wears thin and whether or not they see a viable Republican alternative who doesn't just carry the same specter of drama and chaos around him or her in the case of Nikki Haley.
I want to turn to your focus of scholarship for a moment. You teach courses on African-American politics. And how might African-American voters react to this indictment?
Well, African-American voters are, by and large, Democratic voters. So I don't expect that there's going to be anything in this particular case that's going to, you know, all of a sudden change their likely voting behavior in a presidential election. I still expect that about 9 out of 10 African-American voters are going to vote Democratic in the 2024 election. We don't see, even with sort of slight upticks in Republican or Republican support amongst Black voters, the conventional wisdom still holds true, and I don't see the trend line changing significantly between 2020 and 2024. You know, I think that the larger, you know, issue for African-American voters is going to be who turns them out to vote. So do people actually directly ask for them to show up to vote in elections? And I think that there is an interesting question as to whether or not Black Republicans would react and respond to this information differently than their white Republican counterparts. We had a very interesting Senate race here in Georgia in 2022. And one of the, you know, interesting things to look at in survey data with admittedly small sample sizes was the fact that their Republicans of color may not have responded to Herschel Walker in the same way that white Republican voters did. And so, you know, if we collect survey data intentionally and we ask the right questions, we may see differences in terms of behavior, and we may see a different threshold for the amount of drama that voters of color are willing to accept. That being said, like, we know that the types of people who were, you know, in the crowd at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday after the arraignment, and they included very prominent African-American Republicans. You know, we know that there were certain people who were in the crowd who are always in the crowd and, there to be supportive of President Trump, and those did include people of color who have been long supporters of him.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.